From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The first woman to run for president ran in a time before women could even vote. Her name was Victoria Woodhull, and she was critical of both Republicans and Democrats, said they were parties of the past. Does that sound familiar? Or take Margaret Chase Smith, who would run for president in 1964. She was a Republican who said her party was too extreme. Does that sound familiar? There is a lot in Ellen Fitzpatrick's new book about women's quest for the American presidency that may sound relevant today. Fitzpatrick examines the stories of three women who ran for president. She'll join us today. And she says there are lessons in all of them about the political and social forces that have paved the way for women and still kept them from the country's highest office. The book is called The Highest Glass Ceiling. Join us after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Hillary Clinton came so close to becoming president in 2008, at least the nominee anyway. But Ellen Fitzpatrick says in her new book how much has really changed between then and now. Everything and nothing, she says, which reveals just how complicated the story is for women who have run for president in this country's history. Part of the reason no woman has held the job yet has had to do with the obstacles all women have had to cope with over time. And of course, some of it is circumstance, and some of it is personality, and some of it is timing. Fitzpatrick says women's quest for the American presidency has a history marked by ambition and failure and doubt and possibility. Fitzpatrick chose three women to profile. She says from each of their stories, something can be learned about the obstacles and the opportunities in the American political and social landscape. Today in the program, she's joining us to talk about her book. It's called The Highest Glass Ceiling: Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen Fitzpatrick is an historian, a professor at the University of New Hampshire. She focuses on American political history and women's history. The Highest Glass Ceiling that we're talking about is her eighth book. She lives in Boston, and so she's joining us today from a studio there. And Ellen Fitzpatrick, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
I want to begin with the story you tell early on in the book. I think it's a comment that a lot of people may remember, a story they may remember, but from the 2008 election season. This was an event in New Hampshire, Hillary Clinton event, and there was this kind of outburst. It turned out to be kind of a prank from a radio station in Boston, but somebody had mentioned, somebody had shouted out as Hillary Clinton was speaking, "Iron my shirt." What is it about that incident? Because you sort of begin there, because you say that the ridicule for that incident, for the time anyway, seemed on one hand outlandish, on the other hand entirely plausible. And so it seems like we're sort of in that transition period between those two things. And I guess that's the point of the story you tell?
Yes, I must say, Doug, it's a long transition period, one might say over a century and a half long. In a way, here we had a woman candidate in 2008, Hillary Clinton, who was extremely competitive. She wound up winning the New Hampshire primary that time. An incredible background, a political career, serving as secretary at that point, not Secretary of State, but senator, first lady through the two terms of her husband's presidency, and a lawyer, a former law professor. But as she stood up and began to speak, these hecklers were sort of trying to really bring her down by reminding her that a woman's role is in the House performing domestic duties. And she handled it very well. She very adroitly pivoted and said, she laughed and she asked them to bring up the lights in the auditorium, and she said something like, "Ah, the remnants of sexism alive and well."
Right.
And then she went on to utter this phrase that she hoped that her candidacy might, break the highest glass ceiling. So she it was, I thought, a moment that kind of crystallized these tensions between a woman really stepping out of her traditional role in pursuing the highest elective office in the land and the kind of doubts, at best, we might characterize them that way, that some had about a woman having that sort of aspiration.
You say in the book that this larger history of women running for president, that that's received very little attention. Why do you figure that is? That seems surprising to me.
It is very surprising, and it was surprising to me as I began looking into it. There have been biographies of various of the women who I talk about who pursued the presidency at some point in their political career, and there's certainly been a lot written about women in politics by social scientists. But the history of this seemed to have really been relegated to the margins of presidential history, as in fact these women themselves were. I was astonished to find out that over 200 women over the course of American history had pursued the office of the presidency in one form or another.
Yeah.
Most of them not very significant candidates, but nonetheless, there was a history to be told. And I think in some sense, they were trivialized as marginal, unimportant, and therefore, we had no sense of this context. It's as if Hillary Clinton just, jumped out, full born in 2008, and nothing had preceded her, and that was very much not the case.
Well, 200 over time, that gives you a lot of options. You narrowed it down to three. How did you come up with that choice? What were you looking for in particular in the three that you decided to profile?
It was quite easy, actually, to pick these three because they stood out in a couple of respects. First of all, each of them sparked a national conversation. Their candidacy got a great deal of attention in their historical moment and sparked a conversation about what it would be like to have a woman president. And secondly, each of these women pursued the highest office in the land at a moment when the larger American women's movement was at a moment of high tide.
Yeah.
And there was a lot going on in terms of the political and social movement of feminism that their candidacies intersected with. So it was a combination of this national response and the historical moment that the three of them occupied that really captured my attention.
Well, let's jump in and talk about some of these terrific characters. And one of the most fascinating has got to be Victoria Woodhull. This is how you began in the book. She's the first woman to seek office back in, wait for it, 1872, which seems crazy. Women couldn't even vote at that time. But it's really a remarkable story. Give us a sense generally. We'll get into the particulars here as we go. But give us a sense of who she was. I mean, her character or her sensibilities. I mean, she's kind of strange, kind of eccentric, incredibly strong and capable. A remarkable person, Victoria Woodhull.
Really a remarkable person. The first woman to run for president, Victoria Woodhull, came from very modest background. Her father was sort of a grifter. Her mother clearly suffered from some sort of mental illness.
Yeah.
But her mother also, in some sense, I think, sought solace in the spiritualist movement and became very involved in religious revivals and in spiritualism as that movement swept through the little town in Ohio that they lived in during the Second Great Awakening. And so she would bring her young daughter to these meetings. And so very early on, Victoria Woodhull somehow adopted the sense that the spirits spoke to her. And when they did, they told her that they gave her a sense of election, as it were, that she was destined to have a great future and to be, in fact, she claimed later, a ruler of her people. So this was the climate in which she grew up. And she had a very hard scrabble existence as a young woman. She was married off at the age of 15 by her parents to a doctor who was called in to treat her for a fever. And that became a very unhappy experience. She had a very traumatic marriage to this man who turned out to be an opium addict and spent a lot of time in brothels, neglected her, presided over her labor and delivery with her first child, and she almost died in the process at 16 years old. So really a tough early marriage. She left him, Canning Woodhull, and went west and then became a sort of actress and then herself a clairvoyant and a spiritualist.
Right.
And that was really what led her ultimately to New York and the career that she would later have.
You say what she lacked in luck or fortune, though, she made up for in grit.
Yes.
Explain that, because when you hear the sort of that detail that she was a clairvoyant or she was a medium.
Yeah.
It would be hard to she said she was a spiritual physician. It would be hard to kind of take her seriously today, but what did that mean? I mean, she was what was the grit part? I guess explain that.
Well, the grit part, I think, was really becoming a self-supporting woman with two small children and no husband. In an age in which it was very difficult to make a go of it, she wound up ultimately in St. Louis, where she made the acquaintance of a man named Colonel Blood. There's a sort of Dickensian quality to her story, by the way,
with
these characters who move in and out. And he was a Civil War veteran who came to her seeking advice on his wife who was ill. She immediately fell into a trance, Woodhull, that is, and said she had a vision of the two of them being together for eternity. And sure enough, he left his wife and joined forces with her. They went to New York. And there she made the acquaintance of one of the wealthiest men in the country who was very much interested in spiritualism. He thought the spirits, that if he consulted clairvoyance, as he did, he could communicate with his dead mother. And Victoria Woodhull and her sister became advisors to him, and his name was none other than Cornelius Vanderbilt.
Right.
And what he took from Woodhull, what he remarked about her to others, was that she offered him, in addition to the ability to communicate with his dead mother, remarkably prescient stock tips.
Yeah.
So he came to back her interest in opening her own brokerage firm, which she proceeded to do on Wall Street. She and her sister opened the first brokerage house run by women on Wall Street. And so talk about ties to Wall Street. Victoria Woodhull was a Wall Street broker, the first woman to run for the American presidency. And she became fabulously wealthy very quickly.
She and her sister. I mean, they were the talk of the town. And
people
you say
were
really fascinated in these women, but also kind of skeptical, I guess, which reveals a little suspicion of women who were successful in their own right. And they seemed to have succeeded in their own right.
One of the fascinating things about her success was that it attracted the attention of the leading suffragists of her day. This is a period, this was around 1869, 1870, and it was in the middle of Reconstruction when the women's suffrage movement was attempting to have the Congress of the United States extend the new constitutional rights that they were then debating and soon enacting to enfranchise African Americans to women as well. They thought that you know, here's our moment. They're going to give voting rights to African-American men. Why not give them to women as well? So Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton found out about Woodhull. And Anthony in particular made a foray to Wall Street. She visited her. She was extremely impressed by her. She wrote about her in her journal called The Revolution. And, you know, really applauded the entry of this woman into a previously entirely male domain. And for her part, Woodhull became very interested in the suffrage movement.
The thing I was interested in, it made me wonder, her attempt to run for office.
Yes.
She must have known, of course, it was outrageous for the time. I mean, not only couldn't women not vote. I mean, she herself didn't even reach the minimum age constitutionally for running for president. So what were her expectations? Was this symbolic, or did she really figure she had a shot?
Well, this changes over time, over the course of her effort, which consumes about a two-year period from 1870 to 1872. Initially, her idea was that, and this was actually quite a brilliant insight on her part, which was that she was making the case that the way to advance the issue of women's equality was not in the abstract, mm-hmm. but
not
in the
theory.
Concrete.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, look at Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, if you can have a candidate who exemplifies a particular stance, a posture, a perspective, an ideology, people might be able to rally around the candidate sooner than they can rally around the cause, and you can bring them along. So her position was, I can't vote, but there's no reason why I can't be voted for. And I guess in theory that was right. So she thought, you know, this was a woman who was not lacking in self-regard, shall we say.
You're right.
And I would say that's a universal for anyone. I mean, your average person doesn't, I think, imagine, gee, I'd be a fabulous president of the United States. I guess I'll run.
Yeah.
So, you know, one has to have a fair amount of ego to get in the game to begin with. And she had it in abundance. So I think, in fact, that she really believed on some level that she might be able to take the country by storm. And she certainly made a good effort to do so.
She made this extraordinary claim at one point. She makes this kind of proclamation. She proclaimed that women in the United States are now enfranchised, which was so audacious of a thing to say. Talk about that moment, what she's sort of getting at there, because it's audacious.
Okay, this was really important. I'm impressed, Doug, that you paused on this, because this is quite important to her standing with the suffrage movement. The women's suffrage movement at that point during Reconstruction was attempting to get Congress to pass a 16th Amendment that would enfranchise women. And so she went to Washington, D.C. to listen to the debates over the 16th Amendment. And she, with help certainly from others, came up with the idea that, in fact, it was a more effective strategy to argue that women were already enfranchised under the 14th Amendment, which had been recently ratified, by as follows, that they were, in fact, citizens of the United States. And the 14th Amendment, of course, bars any kind of, effort to deny citizenship on the basis of race. It doesn't spell out sex in the 14th Amendment, but also in the 15th Amendment, which again, barred any effort to deny voting rights on the basis of race or national origin, religion. She felt that women could sneak in under the existing amendments, and she wanted Congress to pass a declaratory act saying women are included under the already ratified constitutional amendments, which theoretically the Congress could have done. Mm-hmm. And she actually was the first woman to appear before the Judiciary Committee. She made this argument, And there was some sympathy for it, but of course it didn't pass. Imagine if it had 50 years before women actually got the vote. Imagine if they had been enfranchised in 1870 instead of in 1920, how different our history might have been.
You know, there are moments throughout the book that have resonance to 2016. One of the things is, and I was thinking a little bit about sort of the ascendance of Bernie Sanders, ironically, he's not a woman, but his claim that he's sort of a pox on both of your houses, sort of dismissing
yes.
Republicans and Democrats. Well, this is what Victoria does. I mean, she says she calls them parties of the past, says they're incapable of unifying the nation. Is there some resonance here, some connection between that moment and what's happening today?
Well, it is true that she rejected the two major political parties. I think what we've seen today that's sort of fascinating is both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have attempted to capture the two major political parties and turn them towards their candidacy. She realized at the outset that that was going to be a non-starter for her. And so she started her own political party, the Equal Rights Party, that attempted to pave another way. And she rejected both of them as overwhelmingly corrupt. So her critique, actually, of the political parties as being corrupt, out of touch, kind of beating the old drum, does resonate with the arguments that are made today. So she was an anti-establishment candidate, to be sure, but she didn't think she didn't imagine that she could somehow capture the leadership of either political party.
What was the reaction from American society to the idea in 1870, between 1870 and 1872, that a woman wanted to do this? I mean, was she at all taken seriously?
She was, in fact, and this was what was totally fascinating to me as I began to read the newspaper articles written about her during this period. It was really remarkable. A lot of them, first of all, she got a tremendous amount of coverage, which she enhanced by forming her own journal to promote her candidacy. And she had the money to do it. So she was very savvy. Particularly for a 19th century candidate, and recognizing that she was going to need her own media operation to promote her, that she would not get, she assumed, good press if left to, you know, the mainstream newspapers. So she but aside from that, the mainstream newspapers covered her in enormous detail, and there was a lot of interest in her. And one of the interesting things that emerged, a very prominent theme, was this response. Remember, the country had just gone through the Civil War, was in the middle of Reconstruction, had seen the emancipation of 4 million slaves, and was watching our nation finally extend basic political and civil rights to African-American men, in the case of voting rights, that, you know, that it was such unsettled times. And so they thought, well, you know, maybe women next, maybe a woman president next, who knows? And some were intrigued by the idea. One newspaper said that the petticoat government that she founded surely wouldn't be any worse than the Grant administration. So it was really very interesting to see what I thought seemed, at least on the face of it, to be quite a bit of receptivity to the idea.
Well, so it's kind of – it seems like it's headed some way. You know, whether or not she would have won, obviously, is a big question. But, you know, she's doing pretty well. She's getting a lot of good press. And then in the spring of 1871, things just kind of start to unravel. There's a family scandal. And during this hubbub, it's revealed that her former husband is still living with her. And this, I guess in some way, it was kind of her undoing politically, I suppose.
Well, she was in fact brought down by a sex scandal, a domestic scandal. And it's an interesting feature of the two of the three women that I write about in the book, that for all that's been said about Bill Clinton, these women had their own troubles. And the husbands of Woodhull and Margaret Chase Smith made Bill Clinton look like a choir boy. In the case of Victoria Woodhull, her mother, who, as I mentioned, was very troubled psychologically, went down to the local police station and reported that Victoria Woodhull's husband, Colonel Blood, was attempting to alienate her daughter's affection, and she was worried that he was actually trying to murder her. There was no basis to this, but it began a police investigation that revealed that Victoria Woodhull had taken in her first husband, Canning Woodhull, who was now dying of a morphine addiction, into her home, and they were sort of seeing him through his final days. And but the scandal that in Victorian America that this woman was living with two men, her former husband and her present husband, was really earth-shattering. Yeah. And it became the major story. It was covered in enormous detail, and it really brought Victoria Woodhull down. She was portrayed as a woman without morals, and therefore utterly unsuited to aspire to any political office at all.
Let's just, as we head to a break here, give a kind of coda, a last sort of reflection on what happens to her. She tries to stand her ground after all of this. And in fact, she goes on the offensive. And this is another really fascinating thing. She goes after publicly, which gets her into trouble, the behavior of this prominent preacher of the time, Henry Ward Beecher. And she gets prosecuted for this.
Yes, Victoria Woodhull came out swimming. This was not a woman to be trifled with.
Right.
And what she said was that she was outraged at the double standard that existed in the society in which women's morality, you know, were held to a higher moral standard than men. Mm-hmm. And she pointed to this Protestant minister who, she said, everyone knows he's having affairs with women in his congregation. And the articles that were published in her newspaper or journal about this led to her prosecution under the Comstock Act for circulating in the United States Mail, you know, licentious writings. And she wound up in prison on Election Day in 1872.
Ellen Fitzpatrick is with us. Her book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. We're late for a break, but we'll take one briefly and get back just in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about that highest glass ceiling for women, the American presidency. There have been around 200 women over time who've made a run at the office. The historian Ellen Fitzpatrick picked three to build her new book around. It's called The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. She's joining us today to talk about it. All right, let's talk about Margaret Chase Smith. You know, it's interesting. There's a kind of a connection, at least she seemed to have a sense of her own destiny, not unlike Victoria Woodhull, a kind of mystical destiny for her life. Is it fair to say that?
I think in some sense she did. You know, she too grew up in fairly modest circumstances in Skowhegan, Maine, which was a textile town and a mill town. And she had a high school education, and she began working very young for the Maine Telephone Company when she was still in high school as a way of earning some money. Her father was a barber, but he had an alcohol problem. Her mother worked extremely hard, and she really, in some sense, scrabbled herself to get herself established and make a living. She was a very independent woman. Mm-hmm. She did not go to college. She entered the workforce, as I said, in high school and really never left it. And she, I think was quite drawn to the idea that she might have some sort of an independent life, and became involved in the women's club movement and as a young woman in her town, and was really quite taken with women leaders. She had gone to one state meeting of the Maine Federation of Women's Clubs and had been very taken by a woman lawyer who spoke there. And, you know, I think had aspirations for herself beyond simply, settling down, marrying, and having children. She later said that she regretted not having children, and she did, of course, marry.
Yeah.
But she worked throughout her life.
Not unlike Woodhull, she has a terrible husband. It's different in a lot of ways, of course, but Clyde Smith, which is interesting about this story, is Smith, who's a philanderer and gets syphilis, and, you know, there's sort of scandal there, but he's her entry point into all of this.
Yes, and that's a critical thing about this story, that for most women to enter national politics, I mean, the most relied upon way for a woman to get to national elective office, really until the later 20th century, was through a male relative, especially a husband.
Mm-hmm.
There was something called the widow's mandate. Alice Roosevelt Longworth put it, sort of less romantically, and described it as using the coffin as springboard. But it was the practice that political parties sometimes, when a senator or representative died in office, would appoint the wife to fill out their term until the parties could discern who they wanted to put up, what, you know, appropriate male would be the right person to run in the regular election. And so, in fact, this is how Margaret Chase Smith reached national elective office when her husband died in office. He was soon to be up for re-election, but shortly before his death, and I mean days before his death, he released a statement, or let's say a statement was released, saying that he that voters should really support his wife as his substitute because she was closest to him and really knew his values, and she had run his office in the House. She mm-hmm. was the office manager and really spoke on his behalf as his health declined. She traveled all over the state of Maine and really kept the whole operation running.
So she what's interesting about her story is, of course, she gets that, I guess, widow's mandate. But then she starts to win elections on her own. She moves from the House into the Senate.
Yes.
And this was interesting, too. She didn't like the term feminist. You mentioned, for example, 64% of Maine's voters. This was in her run for Senate. 64% of Maine's voters were women. So she sort of knew that was a constituency, obviously. So she's tried to play it both ways. She said, I'm a champion for women, but I'm no feminist.
Yeah, and, you know, that's really not so unusual, Doug, for women of her generation.
Yeah.
That is, feminism was associated in the public mind, or at least for these modern younger women, the kind of post-suffrage generation.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to affiliate themselves with these women who they saw as old-fashioned, Victorian, single-minded. You know, they were modern. They were with it. They were in the stream of things. And so for Margaret Chase Smith, you know, this had associations that she didn't want to be identified with. But in fact, she actually was very interested in women's issues as a congresswoman and a senator. One of the first things she did was to sponsor the reintroduction of the Equal Rights Amendment into the Congress when she got into the House of Representatives. She was actually quite supportive of women's issues throughout her career, but she didn't want that title. And certainly as the modern women's movement gets underway, the more radical women's movement in the 1960s, she's a pretty conservative Republican in pearls. Conservative, by the way, by the standards of that day.
Right.
We would see her as a liberal today.
Yeah. I think that's an important point, because you mentioned that she proved to be difficult to predict and manage by party leaders. They were sometimes she was liberal, sometimes she was conservative, again, in the terms of that time. The New York Times said that she was a party all by herself.
She was completely unpredictable, and this was maddening to the party elites. And in a way, it was a way in which she, instead of being dismissed as an outsider or woman, you know, who really wasn't all that important, she used, in some sense, her independence from the political party to gain power. Congressman that served with her said, you know, if she votes, a Republican said, if she votes with us, it's a coincidence. So they just didn't know what she was going to do. And they wanted her vote, obviously. Yeah. And sometimes she gave it and sometimes she didn't. She and her husband both were very supportive of Roosevelt's New Deal legislation. But she was very much a hawk on foreign policy. Mm.
There's this there's the speech that she gives that has resonance to today. I think people will find that same connection, at least that I did. So this is a speech that she gives less than a week after she's sworn into the Senate. She gives it to the Women's National Press Club. There was such a thing in the 50s, and she's I guess it was 48, and she blames the Republican Party for losing five straight presidential elections. And I guess what she's saying is she's urging them to moderation.
Yes.
She's saying this extremism, which will come up as a term in 1964 in the convention, obviously, she says that is costing the party prominence and popularity. Would you talk about this speech? It's really interesting.
Well, one thing that Margaret Chase Smith was really, she represented Maine, and she was actually quite pro-labor and pro-union in some regards. And she did have this background before she entered political life as working as a secretary for the owner of one of the biggest mills in Skowhegan. And she long remembered having to hand out the paltry paychecks to these textile workers as they came in. That was part of her duty. And to see the long hours they had worked and the very low wages they were earning. And so part of her argument in this speech is really that the Republican Party needed to pay more attention to average people and that, you know, the success that the Democrats were having was in part from their attention to the plight of working class Americans who, you know, were struggling for the advantages that so many had. And so in that sense, she was very much a moderate and attempted to find sort of a middle ground. She certainly wasn't in favor. She supported many of the social welfare measures that were the hallmark of Democratic New Deal liberalism. Mm. And that was true even through the Great Society. She was a great fan and supporter of Lyndon Johnson's. They were quite close, in fact. And so this was, she backed some of the Great Society initiatives. This was very much part of her appeal, and it's what kept her in office in Maine term after term after term.
We should mention, this is all going on in the Senate when she's there, but she's an ardent anti-communist, I guess, like a lot of Republicans were at the time. But she has the guts to go after Joseph McCarthy. And there's this
huge moment.
A huge moment.
Yes.
The speech that she gives. And I want you to sort of talk about this moment and maybe start with when she first meets Senator McCarthy on her way to the floor before she gives the speech.
Yes. Well, you know, this was interesting because she knew McCarthy, of course. Yeah. He was a Republican and she, he's a very powerful figure. And fairly early in McCarthy's anti-communist campaign. In fact, just months after he gave his famous speech in Wheeling, West Virginia in 1950, announcing that he had the names of some 200 communists who were then serving in the government, she began, she took notice of that, and her speech chastising McCarthy came only months later. It was incredibly courageous, and she decided as she watched his antics and the way that he was accusing people who she thought seemed to be people of good intention of being traitors, essentially, to their government, that he was overreaching and he wasn't providing any evidence of this and that it was a very perilous kind of extremism. So she decides that she's going to take the floor of the Senate and give a speech about this. And as she's taking the little train to lead her to the Senate floor, she ran into McCarthy. And he, I guess, had gotten wind of the fact that she was going to give some sort of speech. And he said, well, Margaret, it looks like, you know, you're getting ready to give a speech of some kind. And she said, yes, and you're not going to like it. And when she was called, recognized and she stood up, he sat there in the chamber and heard her give this speech. She didn't actually refer to him by name, but she talked about a kind of recklessness in American politics. And she called out her own political party and said that this was no way to try to advance in power she refers to the four horsemen of calumny in really smearing people and exaggerating and lying and destroying people's lives. And it was an incredibly courageous thing to have done.
When she does make an attempt at the presidency in 1964, you mentioned that no woman in American history had brought such deep experience in electoral politics to a run. So she was clearly ready. We need to head to a break here, and I want to get to a little bit to Shirley Chisholm as we go. But what was the lesson that we learn about Margaret Chase Smith's attempt at the presidency in 64?
Well, what we find out is that in 1964, there seems to be almost more sexism in the response to her bid than there was to Woodhull's in 1870. And so it sort of challenges people's ideas that history is a record of untrammeled progress moving forward. She was immediately dismissed as sort of menopausal and addled. This a woman who had in Gallup polls been shown year after year to be among the most admired women by Americans in the world.
Well, not only that, her gray hair didn't help her. It started to raise the question of age.
Yes. A big thing was made of her age. At 67, she was deemed as too old. And she called out the media on that and said, gee, I don't hear anybody talking about the age of my opponent. Suddenly age matters.
Yeah.
And she was a very fit and active and vibrant woman. But some made much of the idea that because she was the age she was, she was menopausal and therefore unpredictable. Could we really have a woman in charge of nuclear weapons with her finger, quote, on the button who, you know, might be subject to fits of insanity or irrationality because of menopause? No, that couldn't happen. So these things were actually said in 1964. It was extraordinary.
Mm. Ellen Fitzpatrick is with us. Her book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. We'll take another quick break and come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with historian Ellen Fitzpatrick. We're talking about her latest book, The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Well, the third woman you profile in the book is, of course, Shirley Chisholm, African-American who makes it all the way in 1972 to the Democratic Convention. And it made me wonder, which was more of an obstacle for her? Was it her race or her gender?
Well, neither were an advantage, let's put it that way. She often said that her gender had been a greater obstacle in her political career than her race. But it was clear that the combination of the two was simply too much for some who covered her campaign. There was an incredible story when she announced that she was running for president that you know, really, I think in the headline and certainly in the first line, she just said this was just a, you know, an impossible idea that a black woman would attempt to be president of the United States. It just simply couldn't ever happen. And so she was greeted with incredulity by many who greatly underestimated Shirley Chisholm's incredible determination that really got her onto the national political stage. And she got there not through any widow's mandate, mm-hmm. but really on her own, climbing up through the often Irish machine-dominated Democratic clubs in Brooklyn politics from the time she was a college student in the 1940s at Brooklyn College.
Yeah. You know, I was interested in a couple of elements here that were so patronizing. The Wall Street Journal, for example, said that sending Chisholm to the House when she was first running might—here's their quote—might tend to perpetuate the matriarchal society said to prevail in the Negro slums. So there's just this kind of rampant sense of racism at the time that she had to confront as well.
Right. It was right in the middle of the, you know, discussion of the Moynihan Report mm-hmm. and so forth, and this idea that somehow a powerful black woman asserting her rights or serving as a political figure somehow diminished men. And her opponent in that race, James Farmer, seemed to be promoting that idea as well, as did some other African-American men who she thought would support her, and some, of course, did, mm-hmm. but others who said it was more important for a man to be elected that would be a role model to men in the African-American community. And she wasn't having any of that. She said, you know, that she had earned her – she'd paid her dues and earned her way and that she had something to say. And she rallied a lot of African-American women around her. It's interesting that many feminists, white feminist leaders, were sort of sitting on the fence in 1972 when Shirley ran for president.
Why is that, do you think? What was the – I mean, you mentioned Friedan, you mentioned Gloria Steinem, you mentioned others, didn't seem to really offer much in the way of full-throated support anyway.
Some of them came around to Shirley, but their position was that it was so important to defeat Richard Nixon that everybody needed to rally around, what, that surefire winner, George McGovern? one can see the point, but on the other hand, Shirley was incredibly disappointed by this. Gloria Steinem did come around, mm-hmm. But Bella Abzug, who insisted on being on the dais when Shirley Chisholm announced she was going to run for president, never endorsed her, and she was extremely hurt by this. And I think that she felt that it was racism at the heart of it, mm-hmm. and she was in one occasion or another held back in the eyes of some by who she was. But she was an amazing scrapper and really got out there. And her basic stump speech could be given today and be completely relevant.
Mm. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton, because you kind of end up with this question. How much has changed between today and 2008, when she came so close? Because you answer, you say everything and nothing has changed. What do you mean?
Yes. Well, I think we still see some of the remnants of the opposition and the doubt and the questioning. You know, for much of American history, when from the point that there were polls in the 1930s, the vast majority of Americans for a very long time said that they would not vote for a woman for president if she was nominated by their party, even if she was completely qualified, quote, in all other respects. That begins to change dramatically in the late 60s and the early 1970s. And without the kind of people like Shirley Chisholm, who really, and the civil rights activists and political activists, who helped to change the rules of the Democratic Party and to some extent the Republican Party after 1968, people like Clinton would never be where they are today. So she has ridden a wave of change in our society through the civil rights movement, through the women's movement, through the political reforms of the late 20th century that has gotten her in the game in the way that she is today. But she also has brought formidable assets as a political figure, which I think in the primary season really have been largely overlooked. And yet it seems like if we look at just the current moment that people are taking a second look at how is it that she managed to do this after all?
Yeah. You also point out that a woman presidential candidate, that's no longer exotic by the time Hillary Clinton, of course, becomes involved. But it's a vastly different political landscape. So how much of a factor is it going to be, Hillary Clinton, this
idea?
It's
going to be a factor.
Yeah.
It will be a factor until the threshold is crossed. Yeah. And what the polling shows today is that most Americans are fine with the idea of a woman president. They say, you know, they're, I mean, nearly, you know, well over 90% say they'd be happy to see a woman president of the United States. But the fact is that until Hillary Clinton in 2008, no woman could really get traction in a major political party. They were seen as being unelectable, and the party elites were not willing to put their money on a horse that they thought was going to bring up the rear in the race. And that, of course, redounded in the inability to raise money. Financing was a huge problem. And then there was the problem for women on third-party tickets of getting the national recognition that is required to really be competitive. Clinton has overcome those obstacles, partly through her husband, and in that sense links up to the old widow's mandate, because we came to know her through her husband's two terms as president. And then through her service in the Senate. And, of course, after defeated in 2008, joining her opponent's administration and becoming Secretary of State, which has led three previous Secretaries of State to the presidency.
Ellen Fitzpatrick, the book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Joined us from a studio in Boston. Ellen Fitzpatrick, thanks very much for the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tony Liu. We had technical direction today from Michael Havey. Video West, produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.